This is the final segment in our series on the American presidency. We've looked at key elections in American history, as well as the qualities that have led to success or failure in that office. We sum it all up with the help of Fred Greenstein, author of The Presidential Difference, Leadership Style from FDR to Clinton, published by Free Press. Fred Greenstein is professor of politics at Princeton University and director of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School Program in Leadership Studies. Welcome, Professor Greenstein.
I'm happy to be with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. Now, in your book, you list several criteria by which you analyze presidential leadership style and really success in office. Let me list them for you one at a time, and maybe you could briefly explain them.
I'd be delighted.
Okay, let's start with public communication.
By public communication, I'm referring to what Teddy Roosevelt called the bully pulpit, the ability of the president to get the message out to the people, to lead, inspire, and communicate. And this, I think, is just a key part of the presidential job.
Okay. Organizational capacity.
Now, this, I think, is one of the rarest things in the presidency. We select people who've been on Capitol Hill, some of whom have been governors of very small states, and that just does not provide a lot of organizational ability. But a disorganized presidency can be a prescription for disaster, as it was when Kennedy's chaotic processes led to the failed invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. And here, I think the great benchmark president is Dwight Eisenhower, who had enormous organizational experience in World War II.
Okay, well, we'll come back to a few examples later on, but let's continue down the list. What about political skill?
The founding fathers really created a system which was not meant to produce results, but in the modern era, we have to get results out of our political system. We have to deal with the health of our people, with the material needs of the nation. And to do that, you need a person in the White House who can really bargain and maneuver and put the pieces together. So I think that's a crucial part of our presidency.
Okay. Vision?
Well, vision is a term that I take from someone we'll be talking about a little more, namely George Herbert Walker Bush, President. President Bush once lightly said that, well, he didn't have the vision thing, meaning that he didn't think in terms of larger pictures and larger directions. Well, it's important that a president be skilled, as I was saying, but the most skilled of the modern presidents, Lyndon Johnson, the great Texas Wheeler dealer, had very little sense of policy direction, especially in foreign policy, and as a result, he very unwisely entered into an ill-defined war in Vietnam, which destroyed his presidency and still scars our nation. So vision is a sense of direction and ability to advance workable and desirable policies.
Okay, good. Cognitive style?
Well, the mind has two sides, the thinking and feeling side, and of course cognition is the term used for thinking. So it's important to know of a candidate or of a president, how does that person think and process information? Presidents vary in basic intelligence, and they vary, I think, in terms of whether they can see the big picture or whether they get lost in minutiae.
Okay, and your final criteria, something that's become quite well-known in the news lately and controversial, emotional intelligence.
Yeah, this term almost seems like a contradiction in terms, having emotion and intelligence in the same phrase, but it's a term that's been introduced wisely, I think, to account for the fact that you get very, very bright people who nevertheless mess up because their emotions are not under their control. And we're going to get into the case of President Clinton, who and inevitably refer to the Lewinsky affair and I think his larger sense of being undirected. So I think it's a problem if we have an emotionally unintelligent president, especially in a nation where the chief executive has his finger on the nuclear button.
Now, you've listed six criteria here. Which do you believe is the most important?
I think the rock bottom most important one is emotional intelligence, and that sometimes translates into the notion of character, that the character of the president is a fundamental requirement for effective and creative and creative leadership. Without that, I think the other things can just be, you know, not pay off for the nation and for the administration's legacy.
Okay, let's apply a bit of this. Now, in your book, you cover American presidents from Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, to Clinton, and we've covered a number of these presidents already in our series, but let's take a look at those presidents we haven't covered yet and that are in your book. Let's start with the person to whom you referred earlier, John Kennedy.
Okay, I call my chapter on Kennedy, Coming to Terms with Kennedy, and I'm interested in perhaps frightening dilemma. This is a man who we now know was very reckless in his private life. Even as president, he was a womanizer of colossal proportions and brought people into the White, females into the White House, really quite indiscriminately. Now, he also was president during the nearest thing to a nuclear apocalypse in history, the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. So was the private riskiness associated with public riskiness. Now, lowering the microscope, as I and others have done on the missile crisis, we see, in fact, that he was very cautious there. He was cautious with the Soviets in general. So there was a compartmentalization there. This was a careful, responsible president who was irresponsible in his private life. And if he had not been assassinated, maybe one would have spilled over into the other. We'll never know the answer to that. So in a curious way, even though I think there's something emotionally unsound about being as privately reckless as he was, from a performance standpoint, he was emotionally intelligent in that he didn't put those pieces. He controlled his emotions where it counted for the American people.
Now, let me stay with that a moment, because I think you're addressing a very important question people raise when they think about which candidates they're going to support, and that is that relationship between private life and effectiveness in office. It certainly came up in the Clinton matter where we questioned, well, really, does it matter what he was doing in his own time with Monica Lewinsky or whomever? Do you see a relationship here? Is this something we ought to be concerned with, or does private life not matter?
I think the president is such an important figure that everything we can find out about him, we should take account of. We shouldn't blind our eye out of a sense of, oh, this isn't quite right, it isn't cricket. If you choose to be president or run for president, you surrender a certain element of privacy. And to take the Clinton example, an entire year was taken out of the Clinton administration by the impeachment scandal and the fallout from the Lewinsky episode. But beyond that, the presidency itself was weakened. By the end of the year, a precedent had been established in which the president's private secretary and even the Secret Service aides could testify about things that happened in private in the White House. Now, that, I think, is a prescription for failing to have good, rigorous consultations within your presidency. So I think the private thing, really, we can see in the Clinton case that it was problematic, and I think if Kennedy had gone on for two terms, the Russians or the Republicans would have made something about his private life as well. Not Clinton, Kennedy, I meant, of course.
Okay, and what about Gerald Ford?
Now, Ford, I think, is a bit of a, he's a kind of a surprise. Of the 11 modern presidents, one who people almost forget about is Gerald Ford. He served a little more than 800 days. He's the only person in American history to serve as president who was never elected either to president or vice president. He would have been appointed by Nixon, and he became an object of humor, and I think partly because of his halting way of expressing himself. People underestimated him. But as I looked at his presidency, I found a person of enormous integrity, a person whose emotions were rock solid, who really had great mastery of his administration's policies. I found, for instance, that Alan Greenspan, who had been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Ford, remembers him as a person of great responsibility. And the other thing about Ford was that after this poorly thought through pardon of Richard Nixon, he bounced back and organized his presidency in quite an effective way. I think the man who followed him, Jimmy Carter, and the man in the White House now, Bill Clinton, could have learned a lot about the responsible and rigorous organization of the Ford presidency. So there are lessons to be taken from this man who will never appear on Mount Rushmore.
Okay. George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, he's another non-candidate for Mount Rushmore, but a person with a lot of strong qualities. He was described as he came up for the presidency as the man with the perfect resume. He had run for the Senate twice. He'd spent two terms in the House of Representatives. He'd been chairman of the Republican Party, head of the CIA, representative of the nation to China. He had been vice president for 8 years. And what you see is a lot of working competence, skill, particularly in building the coalition against Saddam Hussein that led to the 100-day victory and the 100-hour victory in the Persian Gulf War. But I view him as an inbox president. That is, someone who didn't, it's this lack of the vision thing we talked about before. He didn't give his presidency a sense of direction. He also downplayed rhetoric and communication. He was really intimidated by following the great communicator Ronald Reagan, and the result was that in the fourth year of a presidency in which his popularity was higher than that of any of his predecessors, the economy went bad, and he simply was unable to persuade the nation that he was entitled to a second term.
Well, we asked you to come on the program today to really help us summarize what we've been talking about for the past month. So let me, in the very few minutes we have left, simply ask you, because you addressed this in your concluding chapter, what have we learned from the modern presidency that we ought to keep in mind?
Well, let me start by reminding us all of the great aphorism of George Santayana, that those who fail to learn from the past are condemned to repeat it. I think the history of the presidency is in itself an invaluable legacy, and I see many instances in which if presidents understood what had gone on before, they would have done a better job. Kennedy might have avoided the Bay of Pigs if he had seriously looked at Eisenhower's wonderful White House organization. Clinton might have avoided the disaster of his health plan if he'd looked at the way Jimmy Carter presided over an abortive energy program that had similar flaws to it. I believe we learned that we need skill, but it has to be joined to vision. We certainly want an intelligent and thoughtful person, but that thoughtfulness has to be wed to emotional intelligence. The combination, I think, then makes for integrity and an ability to have a sense of direction, especially if the president also works hard to communicate with the American people, to inspire them and teach them and lead them.
What do we look for in a candidate? How do we judge this? What signs do we have of these particular skills?
Very good question. It's very hard to know for sure, but the campaign is it's a little bit like these pressure tunnels that they put models of airplanes in to see what their flaws are. If a campaign is organization is chaotic and people are dismissed and so on, this suggests a chaotic White House. The campaign in its nature is a communication process. So as the pressure builds up and as there are debates, as we have almost invariably now had, you get a sense of whether the preaching and teaching side of the presidency will be carried out by this individual. If there are lots of gaffes and errors of one kind or another, you begin to have a low expectation of the president's cognitive capacity. And then on emotions, sometimes a campaign can just flush out great emotional flaws. A famous episode was that of Richard Nixon, who ran for governor of California in 1992, which was not in itself a wise move. He'd been defeated in 1960 and did become president in 68. But Nixon blew up under the campaign pressures. He accused the press, as he put it, of giving him the shaft. He said he was in the process of giving his last press conference. That proved to be inaccurate, but it was a good indication of a man with major emotional flaws, and this came out in the unnecessary excesses that led into Watergate and the end of his presidency.
Well, thank you. I'm afraid we have to leave it at that. We're out of time, but I certainly would recommend to our listeners that The Presidential Difference is must reading if you really want to understand presidential elections, and I hope they'll take a look at it. You've been listening to Fred Greenstein, Princeton Professor of Politics and the author of The Presidential Difference, Leadership Style from FDR to Clinton.